Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. So tonight I thought it was time to climb back on the soapbox, but I want to do a broad picture by someone I consider to be a great thinker, and this is a doctor who is a colleague of ours. Dr. Paul Grodin is also a intensivist, that is to say an intensive care specialist at Dominican Hospital. I've enjoyed many deep and broad conversations with him over the years, but he has a Substack where he publishes commentary, and that's at paulgodin@substack.com, PAULGODIN. And I'm sure I don't have to tell you how to spell Substack. It's phonetic. I'm going to extract some of the comments. I'm reframing them a little bit from a recent article that he published, a commentary called U.S. Healthcare as a Market Failure. And I'm going to skip some of it and cut to the chase here, and reframe it as the myths of the market and how they just don't work in healthcare. The United States did not end up with a broken healthcare system because we failed to apply enough market discipline. We ended up here because healthcare is the one domain where normal markets will always fail. We keep trying to fix healthcare with the tools of the marketplace, but these tools do not fit the work. It's like trying to repair a beating heart with a wrench. If we want a system that works, we need to stop treating healthcare as a consumer marketplace and start treating it as the social good that it actually is. Free market myths fail in healthcare. So what are the declarations that define the free market, and how do they fail in healthcare? Well, let's start with myth number one. Illness is not a marketplace. Standard markets only work when several conditions are met. Number one, consumers must be informed, and they must be able to compare options. They must be able to walk away from a bad deal, and they must be able to delay purchase until the right moment. Healthcare fails every single test. No one chooses when they get cancer. No one shops for hospitals in the middle of a stroke, and no one compares prices while gasping for air during an asthma attack or pneumonia. Illness forces us into decisions at the very moment we are least capable of making them. In any other market, consumers control the transaction. In healthcare, vulnerability defines and dictates the transaction. The fundamental assumptions of this marketplace mantra collapse the moment a person becomes a patient. Myth number two, the customer will have the information and time needed to make their choices wisely. In a normal purchase, you understand what you're buying. You know the difference between a Honda and a BMW. You can compare features, warranties, prices, reviews. In healthcare, you cannot diagnose yourself, you cannot evaluate your doctor's reasoning, and you cannot know whether a particular test or procedure is actually necessary. The seller knows more than the buyer. This is not just a flaw, it's what's called information asymmetry. Asymmetry is the nature of medicine. Information asymmetry means the patient can't act as a rational shopper. The insurer tries to step in as the disciplinarian, but insurers lack the clinical expertise to evaluate at the bedside. More importantly, and despite all marketing to the contrary, insurers are not incentivized to consider healing and health their main priority, but rather their priority is and must be to return value, that is money, to their shareholders and bonuses to their management. This is a structural problem built into the system. So they use blunt instruments like denials, prior authorization, and administrative friction. I want to take a moment and digress and say that prior to 1988, insurers and hospital systems were required to be not-for-profit. That meant that there was no stockholder, no shareholder, no bonuses based on the shareholders' willingness to give $1 trillion to the president of the company. And why did you not have those things? Well, you didn't have them because it's such an obvious conflict of interest that as healthcare emerged as a major industry, the legislators were careful to set up a system where that just couldn't happen. These were regulations, and regulations became a dirty word like liberal or feminist is in some circles. Regulation was a priori bad, and in 1988, St. Ronald signed a bill called the Knox-Keene Act, which opened the door for private equity to enter healthcare. And boy, did they enter healthcare. It tracks as much as with agribusiness, but for different reasons. So let's go on to myth number three. Demand is elastic. If the price goes up, the demand goes down. Well, healthcare does not behave like the demand for cars or phones or restaurant meals. It's inelastic. When you can't breathe, you will accept whatever treatment is available. When you need an emergency C-section, you will not travel to the next town to get a better deal. This gives hospitals and insurers extraordinary leverage. They can charge prices that have nothing to do with value and cost. Patients can't say no. The entire theory of consumer choice collapses under the weight of involuntary demand. Myth number four, trust is irrelevant. At its core, and I really feel this profoundly, medicine is about trust. We step into the exam room, the operating room, or the ICU with one hope. We trust that the person caring for us will put our interests first. First, do no harm. That's the first part of the Hippocratic Oath for a reason, because we do have extraordinary power to do harm, and we need to never let our own personal self-interest take precedence over that of the patient. Insurance company executives don't take the Hippocratic Oath. Markets do not run on trust. They run on incentives. When healthcare organizations replace the logic of trust with the logic of revenue generation, everything gets distorted. Doctors feel it first. They enter medicine to serve, and they find themselves graded on their productivity as measured by how many patients per day they see. Seeing more patients in less time opens up the chance to make errors. It also interferes with forming the therapeutic relationship, which is so key to the well-being and peace of the patient when they are sick. Patients also encounter surprise bills, deniers, narrow networks. Oh, you can't keep seeing your doctor. They're not on our panel. And opaque prices. Nobody can figure out what anything costs. A system that requires trust cannot function when all of the incentives are undermined. Myth number five. The principal agent breakdown. Buyers are acting as their principal agent when the time comes to buy a car. Your incentives are aligned with the buyer. You are, the buyer. We've built a system, perforce, the physician and the clinician have different roles. The physician is the principal, but they're the client, and the clinician is the agent. The agent is making the purchase decision. That's why drug companies provide doctors with, you know, lucrative speaker fees if they will go and do a presentation as a quote-unquote thought leader. That's why they used to drop all kinds of toys and free lunches on doctors' offices. That's been curtailed, but It's just changed the surface appearance. It really hasn't changed the issue, because now doctors are not even themselves independent agents. We've built a system where most physicians are increasingly employees of corporations whose first duty runs to shareholders rather than patients. Some of them are owned outright by private equity firms that exist to swoop in, buy a distressed asset, squeeze as much money as they can out of it, and then sell the remains off. In theory, free market is supposed to improve choice, but in practice, the corporate market reduces autonomy, erodes trust, and undermines the very conditions that make the patient-doctor relationship possible. Myth number six, competition creates choice. If you live in a city with only one or two hospital systems, you don't have a meaningful choice. That would describe Santa Cruz County. If your insurer has merged with a pharmacy benefit manager, oh, let's say the CVS conglomerate. The same entity owns the insurance, they own the pharmacies, and they own the pharmacy benefit managers. They can take money out of one pocket and put it into another, and you do not have a choice. You have to use, they tell you who you have to use. And if your employer plan offers two or three nearly identical insurance products, you don't have a choice. There needs to be meaningful difference. Hospitals merge to increase leverage and negotiation. Insurers merge to lock in market dominance. It's like wandering around on a field where there are two giant sumo wrestlers fighting it out, trying to, you know, not get stepped on. Once consolidation occurs and you've locked in the market, can anyone say Amazon? Prices rise because there is no competitive force to keep them down. Insurance oligopolies face off with healthcare corporate oligopolies, and they compete for market share. The result is an escalating cycle of price increases, and costs are passed on to the patient in the form of premiums, narrower physician networks, increased out-of-pocket costs, and fewer covered services. This is not a theory. This is measurable. Prices go up at least 20 and sometimes as much as 60% after hospital mergers in an area. Competition does not discipline the market. The market has eliminated competition. The core challenges we face in healthcare in the USA today include private equity. This is an emerging, and it's chaotic. Most, in fact, of the hospital closures that we're seeing are a result of these hospitals having been acquired by private equity firms. These firms buy practices in hospitals through leveraged buyouts, which means that the acquired entity, that is to say the hospital, gets to keep the debt that was used to buy it. The new owners then extract revenue. They do aggressive billing, staffing cuts, management fees, and eventually, when they've sucked the hospital dry, they sell the land under the hospital and let someone rescue them and take over the hospital. Private equity has also aggressively moved into controlling emergency medicine, anesthesiology, dermatology, gastroenterology, oncology. It's closed hospitals, reduced staffing, and routinely use surprise billing as a business model until Congress intervenes. Short-term financial engineering is the watchword of the day. This is not a market that serves the public. This is a market that is designed to extract money for Wall Street from the public. And the only competition in this system is bureaucratic. Fun fact, the United States spends more than any country on administrative tasks: billing, coding, documentation, denials, prior authorization, appeals, network negotiation, compliance, and back-end financial work consume an enormous share of your healthcare dollar. We are spending money to avoid spending money on healthcare. Most of this activity is paradoxical. It doesn't improve care. It's financial engineering disguised as patient care management. Every hour that a doctor spends wrestling with prior authorization is an hour stolen from patients. Every dollar consumed by an administrative bureaucracy is a dollar unavailable for nurses or mental health services or primary care or healthcare workers. And our fragmented insurance system is simply designed to fail. We've got risk fragmented across thousands of different walled insurance products. You have employer plans, ACA exchange plans, Medicare Advantage. Then you have the traditional Medicare, Medicaid, short-term plans. You have Christian health sharing ministries and the uninsured. And everything operates under different rules. When you have a fragmented risk pool where everyone is not in there, it produces adverse selection. People with higher needs tend to cluster in certain plans. That causes premiums in those plans to rise and benefits to shrink. The coverage becomes unstable, and people churn between plans every time they change jobs or income levels. So the plans have themselves no incentive to actually provide good care or provide extra service because they won't keep the patient. The employers are the buyer, the agent, if you will, for the purchase of health insurance. There is no functioning insurance market in the world like ours. The Swiss, the Germans, and the Dutch all use regulated markets, but they make one critical decision. Well, everyone is in the system, and no insurer can avoid the sick. Many European countries use private insurers, private doctors. What sets them apart is that they structure markets in ways that prevent exploitation and protect solidarity. The Rhineland model, that's Switzerland, Germany, and the Netherlands, is regulated competition within a framework of universal coverage. Insurers have to accept everyone. Everyone has to have insurance, even if they're healthy. Well, for one thing, they ride bicycles in the Netherlands, so they're only provisionally healthy, as long as the traffic and trucks behave themselves. Profit is limited on basic coverage. Oh, let me say that again. Profit is actually limited in these systems. Administrative costs are low. Prices are negotiated or standardized. And once again, no one is excluded. These are not an anti-market system. They are markets designed for humans and for healthcare rather than markets designed for cash extraction. We have a moral failure in this system. It's not just an economic failure. A society that treats healthcare as a commodity soon ends up treating people as commodities. That's why so many clinicians feel moral injury. They're being treated as a commodity and being forced to treat patients as a commodity. That's not what we signed up for. So what does a real solution look like? Well, I think you can gather where I'm going here. Everyone has to be in a single risk pool, healthy or sick. Basic insurance does not rely on any kind of actuarial estimations. Basic insurance available to everybody, same basic insurance, doesn't matter how likely you are to need it. Private equity ownership of hospitals and physicians groups is out the window. That has to be severely restricted. Hospital drug and insurer markets have to be regulated to prevent market distortion. Administrative complexity has to be reduced through standardization. Oh my God, standardization. You mean if the patient moves to a different medical care system, a different healthcare provider system, that their records go with them and can be read by the people in the new system? You mean interoperability? Wow, you must be dreaming. Physician autonomy must be restored? Yeah, I'd really like that one. I actually have it, but the only way I have it is I'm in solo private practice. That costs me, but it also allows me to be the doctor I trained to be and that I want to be. And I wouldn't have that in any other system. Public investment must support primary care, and patient costs must be based on income. In other words, means tested. If you're quite rich, you will pay more for your health insurance and more for your health care because you can. You've got to keep the system afloat. And these are not radical ideas. These are normal in most of the world. We can build a system that works, but we need to answer these few questions. What exactly is healthcare for? Is it for shareholders or is it for patients? Is it a commodity or is it a covenant, a promise? The U.S. doesn't need to abandon markets. It needs to tame them, regulate them, and embed them within a framework of solidarity that honors the vulnerable and the ethical calling at the heart of medicine. Until we do, we will keep paying more and getting less. So thank you, Dr. Godin, for a very thoughtful essay. I hope you've enjoyed it. I know it was long. Okay, so something lighter. Let's go to a vaccination success story. The American Cancer Society has endorsed self-collected vaginal samples for cervical cancer screening that aren't actually pap smears. They're screening for HPV, human papilloma virus. The test is easily performed with a vaginal swab, and it's very much like the strep throat swab or the COVID swab. You swab the relevant area and add a reagent, and if it lights up, then you've got a problem. But why this is a vaccine success story is because of the HPV vaccine. Due to the HPV vaccine, we have reduced the number of cervical cancer cases in the United States by 50% in the 30 years since the vaccine became available. This vaccine has reduced both attack rates and deaths, and it's done that by preventing people from getting a virus which damages DNA on the cervix, on the penis, as far as that's concerned, and also in the mouth and throat. And this virus is a cancer virus. It can cause mutation that leads to cancer. And we conquered it. We built a vaccine. And this vaccine and the hepatitis B vaccine are really the two vaccines we have that prevent cancer. I'll come back to the hepatitis B vaccine in the next story. But the good news for women is no more speculums, no more pap smears. The recommendations for pap smears have gone down recently. The current guidelines say that people should start screening. People with vaginas and cervixes should start screening at 25 years old. And when the doctors are checking cervical samples for HPV testing, it's every 5 years for those who have a first negative test. Now, pre-vaccine, people would get the virus. It didn't cause warts. Some papillomaviruses cause warts. Those are the good ones, in a way, because those are not the ones that cause cancer. The other ones are stealth. They go stealth in the cells, stealth in the DNA, and trigger mutations that lead to cancer. Usually, if a woman starts having sex at the normal age of, say, 18 through 25, she's around 35 with a young family when she gets her cervical cancer. That was the old situation. In the 1960s, we started doing pap smears, and we could catch the cancers early, and that made a difference. But now we can actually prevent the cancers in the first place. And someone who has a positive test for HPV needs to be monitored carefully over the next few years to make sure that they do not develop cellular changes. That can be done via a pap smear, by the way, that would be precancerous. And if they do, then we go after those precancerous cells just the way that a gastroenterologist might take out a precancerous polyp that would become a colon cancer years down the line. So self-collection can work. Kits exist. In May, the FDA approved the first at-home screening tool, a wand developed by a company called Teal Health that allows patients to self-collect a vaginal sample and mail it in to the lab for testing. DNA testing is wonderful because it stores. It doesn't go bad. You don't need reagents. It's just, you know, a stick in a bag, and you can even send it through the post. Most insurances right now cover HPV testing, and probably these tests will be no exception. It's just tooling up, so to speak. This was just approved. So don't expect to be able to buy this at your friendly neighborhood drugstore for some time in the future. I imagine initially they will go out to clinics that are, I think there'll be large purchases by government for rescue clinics and clinics out in areas where access to doctors is very poor. Distributing those would catch a lot of cases of cervical cancer and allow them to be triaged to a place where they could be fixed rather than just smoldering away in someone's body for 5 years until they begin bleeding. So really, really a bit of good news there. We're going to move on to a health alert. This I'm prefixing, oops, my phone app said it was safe to eat this mushroom. There have been multiple numbers of people hospitalized in Santa Cruz County, primarily residents of Monterey County, who have become severely ill following the consumption of foraged wild mushrooms. Typically, people show up with gastrointestinal symptoms, but these mushrooms poison the liver and are very dangerous and can be lethal. They also cause something called a cholinergic reaction. You also see this with pesticides, Jimson weed, and Datura. The cholinergic neurons are overstimulated. If you have abdominal cramping and vomiting after consuming mushrooms, and it's usually within the previous 1 to 6 hours, by the way, so it's pretty quick. You'll make the association. How do you know that you don't just have stomach flu? Well, increased tearing and salivation. Your eyes are going to run and you're going to salivate. And go look in the mirror, because your pupils will be pinpoint and you'll be sweating. That triad of symptoms are the early signs that you've consumed a toxin, either a toxic mushroom or another toxin with similar properties, a lot of the cholinergic pesticides, which were acetylcholinesterase drugs, were used widely. I think now their usage has been seriously restricted, but it's still an issue and something you want to definitely watch out for. So just remember, sweating, salivating, and pinpoint pupils, head for the ER. It's not time to try to ride that one out in the bathroom. So last week we talked a bit about vaccinations, and I wanted to give you a little follow-up on last week's vaccine advice and discussion of adjuvants. So here's the advice, first of all. When you're going for a vaccination, hydrate and then make yourself sweat. So I like to make it rhyme. So go in wet, then sweat. And you could drink a liter of water on your ride over to the pharmacy, guaranteeing, of course, that you will be reasonably well hydrated at the time you get your shot. Fill out all that paperwork and stuff. And probably need to pee as soon as you get the shot. But then you're in a place with a public bathroom, so it all works. Then when you go home, by the time you get home and get the tub full of the hottest water you can stand, throw in a little Epsom salts or bath salts and get in there, you're going to be ready to sweat. Have another big bottle of water, keep drinking, and wait until sweat is literally running off your face. Then take a quick shower and you have sweated out most of the adjuvants that were needed to get your immune system to recognize that there was, you know, something evil in you that they needed to build an antibody against. Just a comment, a lot of the fears about vaccines are generated by truthful experiences that are misinterpreted. These are experiences that happened at the time of the vaccination, but they are, for example, feeling faint because you got poked with a needle. Same thing happens if it's salt water. They are feelings of body aches and fatigue, and that's from the adjuvants, not because you caught the flu from the flu shot, although it may feel like a light case of the flu. My go in wet and sweat technique will really help mitigate that. But these misinterpreted things, you know, social media, so they're out there, and then they are exploited by people with various hidden agendas, because that's the thing. The internet has made hidden agendas the order of the day. Prophets shouldn't be making medical decisions, as the earlier essay said, but then there's politics, and that shouldn't be making medical decisions either. The ACIP, which is the Vaccine Advisory Board, delayed their vote on whether or not to stop recommending Hep B vaccine at birth. Now, let's just say that if you have a legal degree, you're probably a great arguer and believe that there are two sides to everything. If you have an MD, you probably understand science and math and believe that there are facts. Who do you want to decide who gets vaccinated? What I want to emphasize here is that Kennedy fired all the members of the vaccine panel and replaced them with allies, many who've publicly railed against vaccines and coronavirus shots. And why would they do that? Well, they have a hidden agenda, generally pulling eyeballs and making money on ads. The former CDC director fired in August said she lost her job after she refused Kennedy's demands to approve the overhauled recommendations. The ACIP was ready to vote to lift the necessity or the recommendation to vaccinate all newborns for Hep B at birth. So let's talk about that. First of all, Hep B vaccine prevents liver cancer, and infants who get Hep B from an infected mom have a 99% chance of becoming infected themselves. I mean, if they're exposed, they're going to get it. They don't have an immune system. of those, 50% will be chronically affected for the rest of their life, chronically infected. And of that 50% of chronically infected, 40%, half of those, will have terminal cirrhosis or cancer in their lifetime. Item number two, the idea is that we're supposed to test pregnant women at their first OB visit, but that misses cases of infection that are acquired during pregnancy. So if a woman becomes infected after that test, in 7 to 9 months, she's going to have high viral loads. And 12 to 16% of women delivering in the USA have no test records. Also, once that child goes home, if there is an infected family member, breastfeeding them, for example, there's a very large chance of transmission of hepatitis B in later childhood. Now, those children are less likely to have chronic infection of the type that I described that the newborns experience. But still, if you vaccinate at birth, you do cover that. Now, major private insurers, after looking at this, the huge, huge pushback from experts in the field, have said, we will continue to pay for vaccines for hepatitis B and at birth through 2026. Great. Okay. And after that, they'll start weaseling out bit by bit, making it harder, putting in bureaucratic barriers. You know the drill. Absolutely no evidence of harm from the vaccine. And public health advocates were especially shocked at the CDC giving a platform to Aaron Seary. He's a Kennedy ally, and he's been a lawyer for the anti-vaccine movement. He's made a lot of money prosecuting companies for vaccine injury. So he presented, and he made a scientific presentation, which he does not have, I might say, really doesn't have the cred to be doing that any more than I should be defending myself in court. One of the physicians, Senator Bill Cassidy, a Republican, voted to confirm Kennedy. Kennedy said that he supported vaccines for childhood, and he supported the current schedule at his confirmation hearings. I guess he had his fingers crossed. We need to push back hard on revamping the vaccine schedule. I'm not saying it's perfect. I'm saying it's designed to protect the largest number of people, which will inconvenience some people who don't need to be protected. This is called the dilemma between a type 1 and a type 2 error. Are you innocent until proven guilty? Are you guilty until proven innocent? And remember, it's hard to prove a negative. So let's move on to something lighter. It is the Christmas season, and we have a lot of buffets and restaurant meals ahead of us. So let's make our microbiomes happy. A lot of this advice is coming from Karen Corbin, an associate investigator at Advent Health Translational Research in Orlando. And she has published groundbreaking studies on nutrition and the microbiome. You can make your guts happy by doing the following. Limit your intake of ultra-processed foods. That's hard. If there is a lower processed alternative, go for that. Now, that may mean, in fact, whole wheat bread, a whole wheat bun. That's not that hard. If you get your pasta made out of garbanzo beans or lentils, that's not so hard. And, we eat pasta for the sauce. I mean, come on. As long as the mouth feels decent. And just even adding 50-50. So if you cooked up some garbanzo pasta and mixed it with your regular pasta, 50-50, you'd be substantially improving what you're feeding your microbiome. Beans are another good source. Most fruits, but especially apples and pears. I love baked apples. That's a great dessert. And it's a great way to get some fiber in there. And sure, throw some ice cream on top. All good, but get that fiber. Whole grains like barley, brown rice, and oats. And we're getting less than half of the 28 grams of fiber that we're supposed to get. And if you do eat more fiber, like for example, with potatoes, cook the potatoes the night before, put them in the fridge, and then reheat them. What you're doing there is you're turning the potatoes into resistant starch, which is harder for you to digest. That's good for two reasons. One reason is that resistant starch, for someone who's diabetic or pre-diabetic, will not contribute to the worsening of that condition as much because it can't be broken down quickly, so you don't get an insulin spike. In the meantime, as it's moving through, the gut bacteria love resistant fiber. And so it will not be wasted. What it will do is trigger the shift of what's growing in your gut to an anti-inflammatory pattern of bacteria. This lowers your risk of diabetes, lowers your risk of hypertension, heart attacks, and cancer, all by changing the bacteria. And furthermore, these bacteria, the fiber lovers that you're feeding, actually help produce GLP-1. So every time you eat fiber-rich plants, especially those high in resistant starch, you're nourishing the microbiome, and you're making butyrate, which is a short-chain fatty acid that helps reduce inflammation. All fiber is beneficial, but some fibers are even better. I've talked about the blood sugar issue, and I want to just emphasize, let's go through breakfast, lunch, and dinner. If you like to eat breakfast, you could upgrade to steel-cut oats. If you like to eat cereal or porridge and warm oats, don't use the instant oats. Cook up a big pot of steel-cut and then freeze the portion that you would eat and heat it up in the morning in the double boiler or microwave. And that is very high in resistant starch and will lower your cholesterol. You want to put some nuts and seeds on top of that, maybe some berries or some other sliced fruit. More fiber. Yes, indeed. You can use nut butters for flavoring yogurt. You can add flax and chia seeds. Both flax and chia seeds are excellent sources of resistant starch. And since reading this article, I plan to incorporate, I think I'll probably go with chia seeds as a just something I consume in the morning as a sort of quick snack. If you eat sandwiches, get whole grain or 100% whole grain. My husband loves to eat Dave's Killer Bread, and there's also Ezekiel Bread. Both of these are high in the right kind of fiber. And if you use lunch meat, try to get lunch meat that is minimally processed. You know, cooked, sliced turkey breast, chicken and roast beef. These still have a lot of cell wall, a lot of undigestible compounds that will slow the ability of your body to absorb it. And you could throw in some extra veggies, right? How about some onions? How about some peppers? Put those in the sandwich. It'll add texture, but more important, because we're on the fiber thing, it'll add fiber. You can take packaged vegetable sauce, packaged spaghetti sauce that you buy in a jar, and you can throw in some chopped up mushrooms, carrots, powdered, dried onions, maybe chopped peppers. Cook the sauce for a few minutes. It hides and cooks the vegetables, but you'll be getting more fiber. Also, as I said, use some of those alternative pastas and maybe blend some of that in if you still love the chewiness of a good semolina. But work yourself up to the highest fiber choice. You're going to do potato chips? Use the vegetable root chips, or use crackers made from whole grains and almond flours, or use nuts. Try to keep the sugar and the starch down and add fiber. It's fine not to eat perfectly, and I will say none of us eat perfectly at the holidays, but some of the traditional holiday treats, like nuts, are all over the place. And whole grains are perfectly useful and delicious. All we need to do is think ahead and play a game trying to add more color and more fiber to our regular diet. It's especially easy during the holidays to go overboard on the sweets. So making sure you eat the vegetables is a great way to save the waistline and perhaps keep you healthier and inflammation-free for the rest of the year. So we've been talking about health insurance, and I wanted to pick up 10 years ago. We're 11 years out from the beginning of Obamacare, and of course there was a ton of controversy before that. Libertarians and budget hawks in Washington often claimed that people wouldn't die if they didn't have health insurance. And in 2017, Raul Labrador told a town hall crowd that nobody dies because they don't have health care. Recently, I forget which representative it was, but when challenged in a town hall about the cuts to Medicaid, saying people will die, replied, "We're all going to die." I thought that was very clever repartee. The ACA became law despite some lingering doubts about insurance impacts on death. But oddly enough, in doing so, it unexpectedly gave researchers the conditions needed to prove something that had been in dispute and really hard to show. The Supreme Court ruled that ACA's Medicaid expansion to more lower-income people was optional for states, and about half of the states decided against doing it. Suddenly, researchers had a way to look at the effects of health insurance in real time on effectively a random selection of Americans. What state they were in was going to determine whether they had coverage. There's a review that was written in 2019, looked at the research on the ACA's impact on health outcomes, and one study estimated an 8% drop in mortality among older adults in expansion states, resulting in 19,000 fewer deaths in the first 4 years of the ACA. Another found a drop of 3-6% in disease-related deaths among young adults in states with expanded dependent coverage. Then came the Internal Revenue Service data. So in 2017, the IRS accidentally created a randomized experiment when it mailed letters to nearly 4 million American taxpayers who'd paid a penalty 2 years earlier for failing to get health insurance under what was then the ACA mandate. The letter encouraged them to sign up for health insurance. But the IRS didn't mail letters to every penalty payer. About 15% didn't get one, creating effectively a control group. Researchers wanted to know what happened to people who received letters and got insured. This could be ascertained from public record. This group of new policies showed a much lower mortality rate over the next 2 years among people 45 to 64 years old. The IRS study really finishes it. We don't have any doubt in our mind anymore. The study's design, if you will, just going back over data, we could be more confident because we could prove causation, one of the authors of the IRS study said. People don't really fully understand exactly why health insurance drove down deaths. You know, I know if you are going to pay out of pocket, you talk yourself out of going. You're like, oh, that lump, I'll wait and see if it goes away next month. I'll just check it again. I can't afford a mammogram right now, and I'd have to go to the doctor to get the order. And, you know, denial is a really strong reason that people get dead. A 2010 study found uninsured gunshot victims were significantly more likely to die in the hospital than gunshot victims with insurance. The authors couldn't attribute this to injury severity, demographics, income, or medical treatment, as hospitals are required to treat all emergency patients, like gunshot wound victims. And in the study, the two groups had similar surgery rates. They theorized that insurance coverage may reflect the many social determinants of health. A 2022 study found similar results with auto accident victims. The authors struggled to explain it. They suggested a higher death rate could have something to do with uninsured victims being more risk tolerance, or more likely to drive recklessly, or have older cars. But a study came out earlier this year which focused on mortality. It was in the Annual Review of Public Health. It looked again at the issue that was last looked at in 2008. The statistical methodology in this study is impeccable. was published in a peer-reviewed journal, but the conclusion that health insurance improved health is no longer on debate. The study could not explore why insurance appears to save lives, but the effect, as I said, denial and budget, the effect appeared to be the strongest among adults older than 45 and, to a lesser extent, younger adults. But remember, it's 45 to 65, and then you've got insurance. So I think we could make Medicare for all work. I'm changing my mind on that a little bit in the wake of this data. It would need substantial modification, but I think that's doable. My goodness, it would cost so much less if we actually had a coherent, fair system that one can dream, right? One can only dream. So here's some reasons to go to the doctor. Some surprising cancer symptoms, according to oncologists, some things you might not necessarily think of. And the one that really caught my attention was medical curiosity number one here. I'll quote the doctor. "I cared for a patient years ago who told me she had chest pain that lasted a day or two every time she drank a glass of wine. A CT scan of her chest uncovered a large mass in her lungs, and the biopsy confirmed it was Hodgkin's lymphoma. Many people experience pain or irritation after drinking alcohol, pain in the lower chest or abdomen due to inflammation of the esophagus. But pain in a discrete, small area occurring consistently following alcohol ingestion, like a lymph node or the lower back, may be a sign of this cancer. In one study, the phenomenon was found in 1 out of 20, 5% of people diagnosed with Hodgkin's. What's going on here? Well, we think that it's because alcohol is a vasodilation. It's a vasodilator. So when you dilate the blood vessels going through a lymph node, and this is a lymph node that is essentially fighting a cancer, that it activates the release of inflammatory chemicals. Another thing to watch out for in cancer is a broken bone with very little trauma. And of course, that relates to age. But for people who don't have osteoporosis, if you fall from a standing height and break something, and you aren't moving fast like on a skateboard, you could have a cancer. So about 5% of cancers involve bone. A lot of the primaries are silent. And so a broken bone that shouldn't have broke, you'll want to get checked out. And a third thing to watch for is when you get your physical, there's usually a calcium level. And people with elevated calcium levels, that can be for a lot of reasons, but you have twice the risk of actually having being diagnosed with cancer in the following year than those with normal levels. Now, the total number of people with high calcium levels who get cancer is low. There are other causes of it. But if you get kidney stones when you haven't been dehydrated, if you get pain in your bones, also when the calcium is really high, we see behavioral changes like brain fog and mood changes. So yeah, checking the calcium is something that all doctors should do. And if the level is more than 2 points above the upper limit of normal, it's probably worth doing some kind of follow-up investigation. Maybe just recheck the calcium a week later. But then if it's still high, go on, do a little sniffing around, see what you find. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.